Welcome to UFO Think Tank Radio with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello again, my friends. Hello. It is I, Alejandro, and it is wonderful to be here with you all again on another lovely summer Monday evening. Fabuloso. I have a great guest today, some of whom of you may get a bit frustrated. I like to say frustrated with an English accent because I like the way the English say frustrated. I'm a little frustrated with the parking at the Olympics. The cab drivers have been saying, it's a little frustrating being able to drive around town. They don't let us cabbies drive in the special lane. And you've probably heard all about that. So I like to say frustrated. The reason why would you be frustrated with our guest today is because he is a scientist that is a little bit skeptical about the topics that we speak about. However, don't turn the radio off yet or turn off your podcast because there's some really interesting stuff here. He's a great guy. He is going to be talking with us about some of the stuff he's written about, which is the science of extraterrestrial life. But also more than that, we're going to be talking about the Higgs boson because some of you have heard of this. They refer to it as the God particle, and you're probably thinking, well, what the heck is this thing? Well, Mr. Dr. Robert Piccioni, who is our guest tonight, specializes in being able to explain that to people. He is a faculty member at many different places, UCLA and Harvard University. He actually got his bachelor's in physics from Caltech, and he has his PhD in high-energy physics from Stanford University. So he's going to explain to us the Higgs boson. However, he's also written a book called Can Life Really Be an Accident? So was it this accidental combination of chemicals and things that what are the conditions? How do we know how life was created on this planet? And so how do we know what to look for when we're looking for life on other planets? If you're like me, you're going to find this fascinating. We're going to get into science and Einstein. He writes a lot about Einstein. He's got several books, and one of those is, you know, The World Without Einstein, meaning, you know, he really was able to come up with a lot of theories and science for which has enhanced all of our lives. He brought us a long way along. So we're going to talk about Einstein and a lot of really interesting stuff. So we're going to brainstorm and think about this whole how did life begin, and I think you're going to find this fascinating because even if he's skeptical that perhaps they may be visiting us, the information he shares gives us a perspective of how science looks at life and more about science and being scientific, but also, as he points out, there is so much we just don't know. So when it comes to life, you know, we hear all this stuff about NASA, going to find life on Mars and all of this stuff, but how do they know what to look for or how these things might have happened? And even these people who seem to be so sure about this or that don't necessarily have it all figured out. Nobody does. It's a gigantic mystery, my friend. So we're going to talk about dark matter, atom smashers. We're going to talk about a lot of fun stuff. If you like science, you're going to like this. If you like, you know, which I think you do, thinking about extraterrestrial life and the different ways it may have come about, I think you're going to love this. And I'll tell you what, my talk with Dr. Piccioni here makes me think of Prometheus, the movie. So I think when you hear what we talk about, you'll see why. So hang tight because this is really interesting stuff. I think you're going to love it. I certainly do. I love it. Good stuff. So, a couple other things. MUFON has a new Facebook page. It's brand new, and I know they just made it recently. And so, you know, they have a group out there but not their own page. So you can go to my Facebook page. Thousands of you are subscribers or my friends on the UFO Think Tank Facebook, and thank you. It's great to be your friend. I like it. So you can go there and you can see that I recently liked and posted about the MUFON's new page. And really, that's the best way to get there, except for maybe go search for pages on MUFON, because it doesn't have its own like simple URL I can tell you to go to at this point. So, but it will soon. You have to have a certain amount of people to like it before you can do that. And I'm sure by this time tomorrow, it will have something like Facebook.com MUFON or something. So anyway, check it out. And there'll be lots of stories being posted there, including all about the symposium, which is like next weekend. Holy moly, it comes up. So the MUFON symposium next weekend, if you're planning on going, I hope you have fun. Tell everybody hi for me. Unfortunately, this is the first MUFON symposium in maybe 10 years that I will not be at. It's sad. But I just didn't get my stuff together. I've been busy with my conference and some other stuff. So, but you can rest assured, my friends, I will be there next year. And I'll say hi. It'll be fun. We'll hang out. We'll have a latte together and talk about some UFOs and stuff. So, however, for now, I'm not going to be there, but there's going to be a lot of really cool dudes that are going to be there and do that. So be sure and check it out, and you'll have lots of fun people to talk to and have lattes with. Who doesn't like a good latte and UFO talk, you know? Fun times. So you'll be able to read more about that at the MUFON Facebook as well as going to MUFON.com, and you'll see some more, including a pretty interesting announcement that they're going to be making at the symposium. So probably hear more about it next week. Cool stuff. So moving on, lots of news to talk about today, including, and first and foremost, I guess a story that's hot right now. And why is that hot? It's that Lee Spiegel striking again. This guy, oh my gosh, he's a character. He has written about UFOs over the Olympics. And of course, in his story on the Huffington Post, he talks it with Nick Pope. And Nick Pope had suggested a while back that perhaps the UFOs would show themselves at the Olympics. His point was that, you know, if UFOs really wanted to say hi and let us know they were here, they could, doing things such as showing up at the Olympics and zipping around and making themselves very apparent. Some people feel as though they did that, and the Telegraph has a video of the fireworks at the Olympics at the opening ceremony, and there is a strange object that is kind of saucer-shaped, and it is kind of glowing, and you can see it floating in the background. And I believe that it's been identified. Don't get mad at me. I'm going to talk more about this, but it looks like a blimp, people. I mean, it really is the shape of a blimp. It moves at the speed of a blimp. It moves similarly to a blimp. Now, some people will argue when you see kind of this luminescence, this light bouncing off of it, that it looks kind of dome-shaped. It looks to me like just light bouncing off of something that is kind of football-shaped. And so you could go to Lee's story and see some more about this. Some other people who have written on, I'm not alone in thinking that this is a blimp. In fact, Billy Cox, who writes for the Herald Tribune, he has a popular blog called The Void. You may have read it. I'm sure you have. He talks about how it's a blimp. And he also talks about how there was a story, and the Washington Post actually wrote about this also, all of the bets being made in London over the Olympics, and that they actually posted a 1,000-to-1 odds that there would be a UFO at the Olympic ceremony because of what Nick Pope said. Now, he asked Nick Pope about this, and Nick Pope kind of laughed. He said, I made that comment to help promote a video game called Resistance Burning Skies, an alien invasion game. They did an interview with him to kind of promote their thing. So he said that, and he kind of laughed because he says, you know, anything in the sky is going to be seen as a UFO just because I say something like this. There's going to be people watching for UFOs and expecting something to happen. And he says, in such circumstances, any light in the sky will be seized upon by people and turned into an alien spacecraft. So, and in this case, it seems to be the case. So, another story on this, which I think was even more compelling, was one written by Open Minds, my good buddy Jason McClellan. You may remember him. He used to do the news on the show. A great kid, this Jason McClellan. And he went on the internet and he found, you know, some people were saying, well, if it's just a blimp, why don't we see more pictures? He found a bunch of videos and pictures that have these blimps. NBC is flying around blimps and using it to film. In fact, it looks like the angle in which, well, maybe not the original video, but many of the videos are from up top because they're filming the fireworks, or they're flying around the fireworks, filming them for television for the American audience out here and the audience in the rest of the world, I suppose. And so there are, he found other pictures where you can see the blimp, and he put these pictures in there, and they do look very similar to what is in the UFO video / picture. So he did a great job, some good research there. Love that guy and his work. So you can see that, you know, I've tweeted all this. So if you go to my website and look at the UFO newsfeed, you'll see all of these stories batting around. And Nick Pope did say and make a good point, too, when he talked to Billy Cox, saying that, you know, if they were able to check the logs, they'll be able to find that out. And according to Jason, I actually just talked to him moments ago. He says that he found tweets from Goodyear where they're just kind of making fun of it, and they're laughing, and they're like, look at what a mess we made. People think we're UFOs, and they're freaking out. So there's the story, guys. You take a look at the video. You see what you think and go from there. You know, like I say, I don't got all the answers. I'm just saying this is what I'm seeing. This is what people are writing. This is what I see. And you know how it is. You know, like they say, extraordinary claims require extraordinary investigation, and they do require then the bar is set really high. Now, if that object in that video had zoomed off or had landed and some creatures came out, which actually happened in the 80s at the Olympics, although that was part of the opening ceremony, but if it would have zipped around or something, or really flown close and, you know, did something crazy, then we would be able to tell for sure. But it really appears to be, with all the evidence put together, especially by Jason, that it's a blimp. So there you go. Now, Lee Spiegel, you know, we talk about him a lot because he's pretty much the only mainstream, you know, national. He's working for the Huffington Post, which is actually the number 6 news source for the internet. And I'm talking, it's up there with CNN. I think it was above Yahoo. It's up there with Google News and all those guys, you know, all the big boys. And Huffington Post is number 6, and they've got a guy on the UFO beat. That's Lee Spiegel. How cool is that? And this guy loves stirring up some controversy, you know, like he did with Chase Brandon, which we spent the last couple of shows talking about, and also with these UFOs over the Olympics. He also recently wrote a story about chasing UFOs, the television show. I asked some of you to give me some feedback on what you think of the show, and there was someone who did tell me, you know, they didn't like it too much. There were some that made some nice comments about my part on the show, and including my sisters and my mom. But more than that, some of you out there who are listeners, and that is so greatly, greatly appreciated. Thank you very much. However, you know, you guys aren't the only ones saying some bad stuff about the show. Apparently, James Fox and Ben McGee, both people, or buddies, I can genuinely call them buddies of mine, say they're a little bit disappointed. It really didn't turn out to be what they thought it would be, and that if they're going to come back, they definitely want some more input into how things go. you know, Ben thought that there would be more science involved, and which was unfortunate, especially because it's National Geographic. And I think we all feel that way, doing some science, you know. And that's why I like to present the news, because it's like, you know, I like to kind of get the information out there and let people determine themselves, as opposed to just, I don't want to hear people's opinions all day. You know what? That's great you have an opinion. It's wonderful, but let's hear the facts, you know, and go from there. I don't want to just hear your opinions and run with that. So that's what they said. Now, Lee did also speak with National Geographic Channel's Executive Vice President of Programming, Michael Cassio, and he said, well, you know, I think they're still trying to figure out how they fit into the show, but he says the show's doing very well, that in fact the ratings are, it's one of their top rated Friday night shows ever. So for Friday night, for the spot it's in, that's what you want to do. You put a show on a spot, you're putting it up against other shows out there to grab some of the viewers and hoping that they are not watching what else is on there on Friday night. And they're doing good, according to him, that the show is grabbing some attention or some ratings. So, and I can kind of see that because, you know, these guys are fun. I don't know. I think that Ben and James and Aaron are very likable people, and that really comes across on the show. So even if you're not getting a lot of the content that you want, some real hard evidence or some that kind of thing, you're at least getting to watch these people who are fun to watch run around and have their little adventures. So maybe that's the appeal. And if it is, well, so be it. Who am I to say otherwise? Right? So Lee Spiegel, of course, trying to drum up some controversy. That son of a gun, that little guy. So I love talking about Lee. He's doing some good work, and he's a good friend, and he is just, it's fun to have somebody out there to be able to bring this stuff to the attention of the wider audience, which is the American public, because at least that, you know, UFO over the Olympics story has really kind of made a buzz, and it's getting to, just like the Chase Brandon one, it's getting to all the other mainstream outlets, and people are paying attention. At least they're looking into this subject and starting conversation and talking about, what about those UFOs, man? What do you think? Other stories, the International Business Times. They, I've noticed, have not shied away from posting UFO stories. However, the Australian version is really going crazy with some. They're posting a lot of UFO stories, which is pretty neat. And one of the stories they posted, which some others did as well, is that there is an increase in UFO sightings in Canada. So Canada is reporting that in 2011, at least these Canadian researchers, Ufology Research is the name of the group, that they have gotten over 1,000 sightings in 20, or nearly 1,000 sightings in 2011, which is almost a record, but the record was in 2008 where they had 1,004 sightings. They said most of these were in Ontario, meaning 406%, and in their investigations of these sightings, 11% have turned out to be unknowns, whereas the other ones they figured were something mundane. So what they say is, you know, they reiterate, because they are more scientific oriented, that we do not know that these things are extraterrestrial, like many people like to say, but we do know that this is something abnormal, and they recommend a deeper look into the UFO phenomena by social, medical, and physical scientists. Amen, brother. You know, I think that's important stuff. That's why I put up together the Cosmic Exploration Conference with scientists, social and physical. Well, yeah, scientists. And Australia, they also talk about, you know, the sightings that they've had out there, and that they've had a lot of sightings out there as well, because, of course, they got to put an Australian spin there, an Australian paper, which is cool, though, because they are taking a very, and we see this, you know, a lot of people think, oh, the media just makes fun of this topic, and they're a bunch of you-know-whats, And it's not true always. You know, there are a bunch of characters out there and some you-know-what, but there are some cool dudes, too, some good people. This is a lot of fun. This picture here that you can't see because this is radio, but this is also in the International Business Times, Australian version, and they wrote a story about MUFON reporting, MUFON getting reports of four different UFO sightings where they reported triangular-shaped UFOs. So here it is. Kind of cool. They put those dates and times together to show, you know, this was over the 24th and 25th of July. And so that's kind of neat that they did some research to figure that out, to say that Texas seems to have a lot of these triangular-shaped UFOs recently, which, of course, gives credibility if there's more witnesses to these sightings. But the picture in question, the story is great, don't get me wrong, but I really love the picture because it's this painting of this kid looking at a wall, and the way the shadows fall, there's like a little UFO drawn on this concrete wall, and it's like he's at a stadium or something. And the way the shadows fall is that there's this beam of sunlight that comes from the UFO, and it's a really fun picture, and in fact, I have noticed that there is at least one tweeter out there, and I can't remember his name, or I would say, sorry, buddy, I was going to say the name of your tweet there, but I can't remember. It's one of the UFO tweeters out there. Anyway, he took this image and made it his Twitter icon, which just shows that he thought the picture was cool, too. So that's why I thought that was cool. But it's a very fun picture, and remember, you can see these stories if you go to the UFO feed on UFODailyNews.com. More stories. I told you we got stories like crazy here. We got all these stories going on. This is not so much UFO-related, although it can be, I'm sure. This was a press release by Raytheon, and that they're putting up a space fence to track space debris. It's just kind of cool because, I mean, we already know that the Air Force does this, and they are just enhancing what they do out there. And, of course, there are so many stories, even of people who worked in the military for these radars or radar engineers. I've interviewed at least a couple on the show where they talk about, you know, I was in charge of these radars, and we would see these things flying around at fast speeds. We don't know what they are, but that we don't think they're just, you know, space debris, that these things are zipping around and they seem to be intelligently controlled, and thus we have credibility in the UFO phenomena. I mean, a lot of these people are military, as we know, you know, that are seeing these things, unexplainable objects. So I just thought this was an interesting press release that they're enforcing or reinforcing their space fence, as they call it, to watch even smaller space debris out there. Because no doubt in my mind, and I'm sure many of you will agree, they're going to get some anomalous stuff out there because that's what's happened throughout history. This is cool, too. And I wanted to tell him what a good job he did, and I think he's a listener. He's at least definitely a Facebook buddy, Shepard Johnson. And he wrote an editorial to the Washington Post. And he wrote about an article in the Washington Post called "The Time When the City Thought Aliens Had Descended." And this was about the 1952 sightings in Washington, D.C. And the guy is kind of debunked it and made fun of it. And Shepard Johnson, however, his editorial said, he titled it, "Why Assign a Non-Believer to UFO Coverage?" You know, and some people have criticized calling people believers. But his point being, why have someone who just completely debunks the whole thing without doing much research? And I so agree with that, because it seems like, and I complain about this often, is that some of these people in the media feel that because the topic is UFOs, they don't have to do their due diligence and do any research, which is their job and which they're supposed to do for all of their stories. And instead, we'll throw out all of this stuff, and not, especially in a case like in 1952. Shepard points out that the person had claimed that it was a weather inversion. However, a traffic control spokesman said that it was certainly not the case. So there's a lot of it. There were jets scrambled and the people saw stuff, the pilots. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why many of these cases, including in 1952, were very interesting. And at least if you're going to debunk it, or at least, you know, get your facts straight, you know, do some research. If there had been research and each point of good evidence was kind of shown to be wrong, that's something different. But just to kind of throw it out there and not do any work, that's not cool, man. That's not cool at all. And that's what they keep doing. Finally, before we get to our interview, a story on a crop circle. Yes, there have been a lot of crop circles this summer. And on my Paranormal RPTR, Paranormal Reporter Twitter, I've been posting more news about that as it comes out. And this is kind of interesting because a crop circle researcher called Andres Mueller has gotten in a little bit of trouble, and he's saying, hey man, it wasn't me. And what happened was someone made a crop circle of his website address in a German wheat field. And so they're like, Mueller, what's the deal here? You just ruined all of this guy's crop, you know, by putting your URL in there. That's not cool. What's the deal, buddy? And Mueller's like, hey, man, that wasn't me. I didn't do it. Someone's framing me. I'm getting framed. And so he seems, you know, it seems credible. You know, this doesn't seem like he's the type of person to do this. He's just saying some crappies out there, that's who they call the people who make crop circles. Because Lord knows there are people who make crop circles. Maybe not all of them. You know, you have your opinion on that. But even crop circle researcher Colin Andrews said at least 80% are human-made. The others, he says, are anomalous. That's strange stuff going on. But Mueller is not happy about the situation, and they are trying to get money out of him. And he's saying, look, I didn't do it. Leave me alone. I'm sorry that these guys did this, but I'm not responsible. And so we'll see what happens. But Crop Circle, the debunker, says he was framed, is what they say. And he's not a debunker overall. He's a researcher, but he has debunked some, including this one that, you know, is his website. He was very easily somehow able to say, I don't think that one is anomalous. So there is the UFO news for the week. Check out UFODailyNews.com for more, and you can sign up for the Twitter to be updated on a nearly daily, well, a daily basis, nearly hourly basis. But you can also just go to UFODailyNews.com and see some stories there, or look at the UFO news feed, and you'll be up to date on the latest. However, right now, let's talk some ET science with Dr. Robert Piccioni. I like Italian names. Piccioni. I am really happy to have Dr. Piccioni here on the phone. Thank you for coming to do the interview, and welcome.
Well, thank you, Alejandro, for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I'm really excited to be talking about this because, of course, the Higgs boson is a big deal right now. Well, it seems to kind of been faded a little bit, but also some of the other work you've done, such as talking about life in the universe. And then hopefully maybe you can help us tie in some of the theoretical physics later on. But I guess just to start off with just a couple quick questions about Higgs boson before we get into life out there on other planets. Is that, you know, this hit the media. It was a big deal. At least scientists obviously were very excited about it. And however, it seems that it's kind of maybe just over people's heads where the story's kind of faded. Should it I mean, be it bigger than the media is making it, or than people are taking it right now, or is it mostly just kind of something more exciting for scientists?
Well, primarily it's very exciting for physicists, and that's for a couple reasons. One is that physicists have been searching for this thing for 40 years, so it's a great relief to finally have succeeded. Secondly, you know, physics is a business in addition to a science, and like any business, it has to find ways of supporting itself financially. It needs an income, and so physicists have succeeded in getting governments across the world to finance this $10 billion machine particle accelerator near Geneva. And the primary justification was to search for this Higgs boson. And if they hadn't found it, that'd probably be the last time in the history of science that they were able to fund such a big project. So it was a great relief that they sort of made good on their commitment. And this is also the first particle that's been discovered, the first new fundamental particle that's been discovered in the last 17 years. And it rounds out the list of everything that had been expected to exist in nature. So for all those reasons, physicists are very excited about it. But on the other hand, we've already assumed for 40 years that it existed, and so it's already built into all the theories of physics, and so this discovery doesn't change anything. We've always assumed that it was there, and now we know for sure that it is. So it really doesn't have that much impact on the general public. The Higgs boson is supposedly the particle that results in all of the other particles having mass. And that's an important thing for physicists to explain, but we already knew they did have mass. So, you know, it hasn't really changed the bottom line in any sense.
It's probably got to be a little scary, too, because people have been teaching this for a long time. When it's discovered, it could be a little different than it was thought to be, and that changes everything. So is it kind of a sigh of relief that, oh, thank goodness it's there, we can finally mark this off as discovered in our books and move on?
Yeah, to some extent. Many things wouldn't have changed if it wasn't there. Quantum mechanics would still be entirely valid. It doesn't depend on the Higgs boson at all. Einstein's theories don't depend on the Higgs boson at all. So those major theories of science, which are really the pillars of science, would have remained unchanged. It would have been a continuing difficulty for particle physicists and the so-called standard model of particle physics, but, you know, that's not something that most people are impacted by it in any case.
Mm-hmm.
It would probably have had an impact on cosmology, but since we've been expecting it, and since we knew what its effects were anyway, the fact that it exists isn't new news.
Now, was this one of the primary missions of the Big Super Collider, or are there other major goals that are still out there for it?
Well, in order to justify the $10 billion, the physicists put together a list of things that they hope to discover. And the Higgs boson was number one on the list. They also have some prospect, although it's not clear how likely, they have some prospect of making inroads into understanding what dark matter is. And there are other particles that may exist, which are called supersymmetric particles, that they hope to identify. But those things were less interesting, perhaps, than the Higgs boson. And so if they hadn't found the Higgs, that would have been a major disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you build a new machine like this, the real motivation is not to fill in the blanks of what you think you know. The real motivation is to discover something you had no idea existed at all.
Ah.
You know, so every time we've got a better microscope or a better telescope or climb to the top of the next highest mountain, humanity has found things that were truly amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real reason we do these things.
Yeah.
For the discovery of what no one had a clue existed. So if all that this accelerator discovers is the things that were on the checklist that justified the financing, then that would probably be the biggest disappointment of all.
That'll be pretty boring. And how difficult, you talked about how the Higgs boson, or boson, that dark matter, it sounded like it's going to be a lot more difficult to discover. So what from what I understand, they're like smashing atoms together. The things that fly out from this explosion are the things that they're looking at, and they can find the boson. And so how much more difficult then is it to discover other things?
Well, the dark matter is probably going to be a lot more difficult because it doesn't really interact with normal matter. So let me step back a second and sort of give you the overview of particle physics in a simple way. There are now 17 known particles which are not made of anything else. So these are called the fundamental particles. And everything else in the universe is made of these guys. In fact, everything else in the universe is made of only three of these guys.
Wow.
So this is completely different than what we see around us in our everyday life. I mean, if you look around you, you know, every person is unique. Every star is unique. Every mountain is different from every other mountain. Every snowflake is unique. And so there are trillions and trillions of different stuff in the universe. But if you take those things apart, then you find out that they're all made of molecules, and there's only millions of different molecules. In fact, almost all of those molecules are made by different types of life. If you just look at the molecules that have nothing to do with life, there are only 10,000 molecules that can be made. And all of those molecules are made of atoms, and there's only hundreds of those, including all the isotopes. And all of those atoms are made of particles, and there's only 17 of those. And really, all the atoms are made of only three of those 17 particles. So as you get to the smaller and smaller stuff, you know, like peeling away the layers of the onion, you find that there is less and less diversity until finally there's almost nothing. There's almost no diversity at all. It's you know, there's just three things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like saying the entire universe is made of three different types of Legos.
Right.
You know,
that's amazing.
That are snapped together in all different ways, and you make all this creative and wonderful stuff, but they're all just made of three little parts. And the universe could have been really different. I mean, you know, the universe could have had billions of fundamental pieces, but the amazing thing is it doesn't. It's the same stuff everywhere. And so here we have this small collection, this, you know, 17 different things, and 12 of these are called fermions, named after Enrico Fermi, who was the mentor of my father.
Oh, wow.
And Fermi was one of the most famous physicists of the 20th century, and there's a whole bunch of stuff named after him, including the biggest particle physics laboratory in the United States. And so these fermions are the particles, the fermions include all the particles that make up all the matter of everything that we see around us, including those three particles that I talked about before. And half of them are quarks, and those make up the nuclei of atoms, and the other half are leptons, which are include the electron. And so there's six leptons, six quarks, and there's 12 fermions, therefore. Now, the other side are called bosons, named after an Indian physicist, Satyendra Nath Bose, and there's five of them now. So the bosons are what are responsible for the forces. So the fermions are the matter, and the bosons are the forces. So the force of electricity, or the nuclear force that holds nuclei together, the magnetic force, all of these forces in nature are because bosons are carrying the force between one particle of matter and another. So it's like two baseball players throwing the baseball back and forth, right? So when the baseball player throws the baseball to his colleague, that baseball is carrying a force between the two of them. And so the boson is the baseball, and the fermions are the players. And so there's a boson that carries the electromagnetic force, there's a boson for the nuclear force, and there are two bosons for the weak force, and now there's the Higgs. So there's five. And that combination of those very few, you know, sort of handful of particles explains all of matter and all of the forces of nature.
Wow.
And it's, in a sense, it's really simple. I mean, there's not much there. There's just a few things. The math is horrendous, but, you know, forget the math. The idea is that there's just this handful of stuff. And so really, that's why we can understand the universe.
And like you said, it's been taught the Higgs boson for 40 years, and it's math that is this correct that discovered that it exists, theoretically at least?
Yeah, there's experimental evidence that it exists. The evidence is actually that there is a new particle with a appropriate mass and characteristics that are consistent with being a Higgs, but it's going to take a while to prove that that really is the Higgs boson. But there's no other expectation for any other particle with that mass, so, you know, it's a pretty good bet.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence is extremely solid that there is something new, and everybody is happy about that and assuming it's going to be proven to be the Higgs, but it hasn't been definitively proven that this is indeed the Higgs boson.
Okay. But the evidence was recent. However, prior to that, it was just the math.
It was just somebody's suggestion, and it was good math, and it was a good suggestion, but you know what? 99% at least of those ideas turn out to be wrong. You know, nature is tough on us.
Uh-huh.
Nature doesn't give up secrets easily, and even the very best ideas of the most profound and scientists in the world, 99% of them are wrong.
Yep, we often underestimate her.
Yes, yes. So, you know, if you look at someone like Einstein, he was wrong probably half the time, and that gives him a 500 batting average. And just like baseball, 500 batting average makes you the MVP.
Yeah, that ain't too bad. Well, and it's just fascinating also, just physics itself, and that all of these numbers and calculations can predict something such as this, a force. Or something responsible for forces in nature, which then is able to be proved in a super collider. That's just a fascinating process.
You know, sometimes the human brain just blows you away with how capable it can be. It's just incredible. You know, that the example that I like the best, if I can digress a little bit.
Go for it.
Albert Einstein sat in a room with no windows in Zurich, Switzerland, 100 years ago, and he came up with an idea about how gravity should work. And, you know, it's his theory of general relativity. And he calculated what would happen if two massive objects were orbiting each other, and he predicted that they would lose energy because they would, gravity waves would spread the energy away from those two objects, like, you know, if you take a beach blanket and you shake it, right? These waves would propagate away, carrying away energy. And 80 years later, they discovered neutron stars. And when Einstein came up with this idea, we hadn't even discovered the neutron yet, let alone the notion that you could have a whole star made of nothing but neutrons. And then we discovered there were two neutron stars out there called the binary pulsar, and they're orbiting each other in 8 hours. I mean, they're really close. Two giant stars,
wow.
Each of them more massive than the sun, and they're, you know, so close that they go around each other in only 8 hours. And they measured how much energy those stars were losing because of the gravity waves, and it matched Einstein's calculation exactly.
Wow.
And here, you know, he had done this all in his brain. There was no evidence for it, even the existence of neutrons, let alone neutron stars, let alone binary pulses. I mean, no one knew any of this stuff. And here is this pair of objects that are 100,000 million, million miles from Earth. And he figured out exactly what they were going to do. I mean, that just blows me away.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, that it's just, there aren't words for how incredible that is.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's what the human mind can do in physics, and the human mind can do great things in literature and, you know, music and art. And, you know, we all know that humans can be terrible in addition to that, but, you know, it's nice every once in a while to step back and think of the good things that our species can do. And
right.
We should be proud of that.
Well, and that, I guess, could segue over us over to another topic based mm-hmm. on a book that you wrote. Can life be merely an accident? And I guess ultimately getting to the question, are there other brilliant minds out there on other planets? But the question you're asking here, which is, it seems, especially in today's world with NASA and Kepler and all the discoveries going on, And it doesn't seem like it used to be like this, maybe even 10 years ago. People seem to hold and regard this idea, oh, life is just an accident, you know, everything happened just right here on Earth, probably wouldn't happen out there again. Now that seems to be a very, very, an idea that's in the minority. But there are still scientists out there saying this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But your book addresses this, and what perspective did you take on it?
Well, I think that the origin of life is the greatest mystery that remains to be addressed in science. Now, most scientists will probably tell you that life did begin by a random chemical process, that the right atoms just happened to bang into each other in just the right way, and poof, out came DNA or something like that that formed the first life, and after that, it's just reproduction and mutation. And, you know, that's Darwinian evolution after you form the first life, and that's fine and dandy, but what I'm really interested in is how did you make that first organism that you could call alive? Well, as I say, most scientists have said for 50 years or more that life began by a random chemical reaction, and even if it's very improbable, all you have to do is wait long enough and it will certainly happen. But no one actually did the math. And one reason that they didn't do the math to confirm whether that or not that made any sense is we didn't have numbers like the size of the universe and the age of the universe and the amount of carbon and what was the smallest amount of DNA that life actually took. But now we do. You know, in the last 10 years, in fact, we have measured to high precision the size of the universe. We know that to 1%. We know the age of the universe to 1%. And in the field of DNA, having sequenced the human genome and other genomes, the leading genomists in the world have concluded what is the smallest amount of DNA it takes to support life. So now you can actually do the math. And so what I've done in my book is I listed all of the physical requirements that are necessary to form any sort of life whatsoever and estimated the probability that each of these things could have occurred by random chance. And there are a lot of requirements with lots of different results. Some of them are as likely as 1 in 1,000, which isn't so bad. And some of them are as likely as 1 in 1 billion, or as unlikely as 1 in 1 billion, which is sort of a stretch. And some of them are as unlikely as 1 in 1 trillion, which is really kind of pushing it. But the one that is the least likely of all to have occurred by random chance is the formation of the smallest amount of DNA that's required for life. So the DNA in a human being, to start off with, is very complicated. All DNA that we've ever found has follows the same biochemical design. It all is composed of a four-letter alphabet that spells out the amino acids that go into producing the proteins that support the organism's life. Okay, so in a human being, you have over 3 billion of the letters of that alphabet that spell out what it is to be a human being. And if you put all that in a book like with the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica, it would take 1,500 volumes to specify the code for any individual human being. And your code and my code, Alejandro, would be the same, and the same as everybody else in the world, to the level of 99.9%. So the only thing that makes any individual different from any other individual is that last tenth of a percent, or, you know, a few pages out of that 1,500 volume encyclopedia. Well, so we are pretty complicated, but the simplest form of life has 500,000 of these letters in its alphabet, 500,000 of these DNA units called nucleotide base pairs, and each of those has four possibilities. And so if you do the math, it turns out that there are a staggering number of possible arrangements that you could form in 500,000 letters. And the number of arrangements is so large that it's actually a number that has 203,000 digits in it. So if you were to write the whole number out, it would fill a book. It would completely fill a 300-page book to write out all of its digits.
Wow.
Well, so I calculate. So I ask myself the question: well, how, you know, is the universe big enough? Is the universe old enough? Does the universe have enough carbon and everything else to make it reasonable that this enormously complicated structure, this DNA of the simplest organism, could have occurred by random chance even just once? And so no one had done that calculation before, to my knowledge. And, you know, the reason is, I suppose, that no one knows how many times the right molecules actually did bang into each other the right way, right? No one was around to record that, so how do we know how to do the math? Well, so I used a technique that is commonly used in particle physics, and that is, I calculated the maximum number of times those molecules could have interacted in the most generous possible scenario. And if you can show then that the maximum number of times is not sufficient to create life, then whatever the actual number of times these molecules interacted would also not be sufficient to create life, right? If the maximum isn't good enough, then whatever the actual number is also will not be good enough. So the next step is, how do you figure out what's the maximum number of times these molecules could have interacted? And I took the most optimistic possible scenario. So I said every carbon atom in the universe was incorporated into these nucleotide base pairs of DNA, and I assumed that every nucleotide base pair was in an ideal habitat, at least as good as the Earth. And, you know, both of those are ridiculously optimistic assumptions, but, you know, I'm going for the max. And I assumed that they all interacted in the same place from the moment of the Big Bang until today, and there, you know, that's as much time as there is, and that they all interacted a billion times a second, which is far more than any typical chemical reaction, and in fact the molecules can't move fast enough to get out of the way. So even in that wildly optimistic scenario, the number of different combinations that could have been tried is a number with only 102 digits. But you needed 203,000 digits. So you're not even close. I mean, you're not even in the same ballpark. You're not even in the same universe. So to translate this into something perhaps more approachable, the probability that any organism could have been formed anywhere in the entire universe, even once in the entire history of the universe, that's less likely than drawing the ace of spades from a deck of cards and repeating that feat 119,000 times in a row.
So it's highly, 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 highly unlikely it was an accident.
Yeah. So anything else you can think of is going to be more likely than that.
And in fact, in your wildly optimistic scenario that you put together there, is that scenario, though, would it fit like a Goldilocks planet? I mean...
Yeah. So, I mean, that's assuming every planet in the universe is in the perfect habitat.
Mm-hmm. And we're finding a lot of them, though.
We're finding a lot of planets. We're not finding that many that are at the right distance from their stars. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let's go back a second. One of the chapters in my book is how special is the Earth, right? Because that's mm-hmm. a... important factor if you're going to talk about the origin of life. And I list 13 things about the Earth that are pretty special. And NASA is very excited with the Kepler satellite and other ground-based satellites, and they found over 1,000 planets that are orbiting other stars. But so far, they're just looking at one or two of these characteristics of the Earth that they're trying to match with these other planets. And if you look at a plot of, you know, the distance from the star versus the mass of the planet, you find that the Earth is way out to the side of the chart. And there really isn't very much at all that's been discovered so far that comes close to matching the Earth. In fact, there's nothing that's been discovered that's as close to Earth as the planet Venus. Venus is much more similar to Earth than any other planet that's been discovered outside of our solar system.
Hmm.
And the surface temperature of Venus is 660 degrees.
Yeah, a little warm.
Yeah. I mean, you know, no life's going to live there because, you know, any biochemical molecule that you want to build life out of would simply disintegrate. So... you know, it's nice to find all these planets, and it's exciting, and, you know, we're going to find more, and we're going to find more Earth-like planets. But, I mean, the bottom line is Earth is really a phenomenally special place. And, you know, I like to quote the head of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the chief technology officer. His name is Dr. Paul Dimitakis, and he's, you know, one of his jobs is to find Earth-like planets. And he says, good planets are hard to find. You know, he's a man of few words. And the next sentence he said was, we got to take care of this one. So I don't know what caused life. The point I'd like to make is it's a great mystery, and science at the moment doesn't have a clue. This notion that it's a random accident through known chemistry and physics, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly something created life, and I don't know what that mechanism is. You know, anybody's guess is as good as anybody else's in the absence of any scientific evidence. And but something did create life, and I don't see any reason why that mechanism wouldn't create life elsewhere in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Even if Earth is one in a billion, which is my estimate, there's still going to be lots of Earth-like planets in the universe, and life is almost certainly going to exist on some of them.
And it would seem almost kind of it doesn't fit with what we seem to have discovered in science thus far as when we recognize the phenomena, it's rare, if ever, that it's just a solitary phenomena, that most
right.
of things have repeated themselves in similar environments before.
Right. And so we used to think the Earth was the center of the universe, the Earth was the center of the solar system, or the solar system was the center of the universe, or the Milky Way was everything there was. So as science has progressed, we've recognized more and more that our location is nothing special. I mean, the galaxy is not the only galaxy, and the sun is not the only star, and so on and so on. So we would expect that the environment that we have around us is not unique in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is much more rare than a lot of people will tell you.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha, at least especially in what we've seen so far. But
yeah.
It would be, what about the other indications? So, for instance, would you be more skeptical than perhaps NASA or many scientists are when they find evidence of water, let's say, on the moon or Mars, that necessarily means life was or is there?
I mean, was or is there water, or was or is there life?
Life. In that, okay, it seems like, you know, there's a lot of excitement where water equals life. But that's not necessarily the case.
No. I mean, I think it's very unlikely that you're going to find life without water, without liquid water. But just having liquid water, I don't think, is good enough to have a high probability of life.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering...
Well, I mean, let me give you an example.
Okay.
It turns out one of the properties of the Earth that's particularly favorable for life is that the Earth's orbit around the sun is nearly circular.
Hmm.
One of the things we don't know about all of these exoplanets is how elliptical their orbits are. That typically is not something that comes out of the measurements of Kepler. We know what their average distance from the sun is, which is an important requirement, but we don't know how elliptical those orbits are. Okay, so if you were to have a planet orbiting our sun at the same average distance as Earth, but if that planet had the ellipticity, the eccentricity of its orbit, that's the average of the other planets of our solar system, which is the only solar system that we really understand very well. So if it had an average eccentricity, then the Earth would be in an elliptical orbit that would have liquid water only in April and October. So the rest of the time, it would either be too close to the sun, it would be closer to the sun than the habitable zone, and the water in the ocean would boil away. And the other months of the year, it would be outside the habitable zone, too far from the sun, and the ocean would freeze solid.
Uh-huh.
So here is a planet with the right average orbit, which is all that Kepler tells us about, but which probably is inhabitable.
Gotcha.
Because for 5 months of the year, the water is evaporated, and for 5 months of the year, the water is solid. So, you know, I mean, maybe a life could evolve on that. You know, I can't prove it can't, but it doesn't sound like a place we'd want to live.
So that even a Goldilocks planet, we don't necessarily know the elliptical orbit, and which would then equal the variance, like in the temperatures and things like that.
Right. And, you know, there are planets that have extremely elliptical orbits. I mean, Mercury has a very strong eccentricity, and so does Pluto. Earth has a orbit that is nearly circular, and so we stay in that Goldilocks zone the whole year round. In fact, there's very little variation in the exposure that we have from the sun from one part of the orbit to the other.
We're only barely in it in the summer in Arizona, though. Just barely.
Well, it's pretty hot in Phoenix. I've been in Phoenix when it was 119.
Oh yeah, you're hiding inside in the AC.
You know, I was in Phoenix many times in the summer, and I'd drive down the street in my air-conditioned car, panting, and there were guys on the rooftops laying tar. God, how do they survive?
Yeah, some people get used to it. Sometimes you'll see people out here with a hoodie walking around, and it's 110, and you're thinking, what are they doing? I'm from Colorado, so, and I've only been here a couple of years, so.
I see. Okay.
I love the sun, but I'm not totally used to high temperatures.
Well, you know, what you point out is a great point. Probably only about 20% of the Earth's surface is habitable for a species like human beings.
Ah.
Right? So we think of this as a beautiful planet, but bursting with life, and that's true.
California.
But even on Earth, there are vast stretches of the Earth that aren't really very conducive to life, and there,
right.
You know, there's sections of the ocean that are more barren than the Sahara Desert.
Mm-hmm.
So life is kind of fragile.
Right.
Yeah. But it's a great pursuit. It's a great mystery, and it's an exciting area to be working on because it is a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one day we'll eventually, learn a lot more, and that'll be a lot of fun, and I hope it happens in my lifetime. But the point I want to make most firmly is that as of now, science really doesn't have a clue how life began. And I guess I'm offended periodically by science who sort of take this holier-than-thou attitude and claim that they've understood all this, and anybody that doesn't believe in their theory is, somehow mentally inferior and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
And then, they, for whatever reason, make a point of attacking people's religious beliefs. And all that, I think, is completely inappropriate and, completely irrational. I mean, they're welcome to have their whatever personal beliefs they want to, but this notion that theirs is their personal belief is better than anybody else's is just arrogance.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were talking before, about life being because of the right particles or atoms are smashing together and mm-hmm. happening, would it be theoretically possible for us to discover how to the right things to smash together in our super colliders to make life?
Well, when in the super collider, no, because the super collider is really looking at the fundamental particle level,
mm-hmm.
and the temperatures, the equivalent temperature to what's happening in the super collider, is it's well over a trillion degrees. So you're not going to be making anything, any organic molecules. Mm-hmm. stuff just evaporates at those temperatures. It's much hotter than the center of the sun. They're looking to recreate temperatures that existed in our universe at about a trillionth of a second after the beginning of the Big Bang. Now, but, we shouldn't have to create any special experiment, because if indeed life did begin by accident, then the question is, why isn't that continuing? Why don't we have new life being formed all the time? Why can't you take a bucket of seawater and find spontaneously created pieces of DNA that are half as long, let's say, as the minimum for life? There should be a trillion times more of those than living organisms. They're much easier to put together.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we don't see any of these primitive components really is, in a sense, testimony to the fact that maybe it didn't begin that way.
Gotcha. So, yeah, because if there was this inception of life, then we should have seen it repeated on this planet.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense. What are your ideas, then, about how life might have been created?
Well, I'm really not promoting any idea because, there's nothing, there's no scientific evidence that points in any direction as opposed to any other direction.
Mm-hmm.
I know about six or eight ideas that have been proposed, and none of them are ridiculous, but none of them are supported by scientific evidence either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously the one that most people accept is that life was created by God. And that's fine. There's no scientific evidence to deny that. But there's no scientific evidence to confirm that. So, you know, it's a valid choice. It's an act of faith. Stephen Hawking will tell you there is no God, and he will tell you that the reason that life exists is there are an infinite number of universes, and however unlikely it is in any one universe, it eventually has to happen when you multiply by infinity. And there's a lot of scientific... there are a lot of assumptions that he's made in coming up with that that are not supported by any scientific evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so his conclusion is another act of faith. You know, he's choosing to believe a sequence of assumptions, which none of which he can prove, and none of which are supported by scientific evidence, but he's chosen to believe those. And so that's an act of faith, just like believing in God.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who say that, you know, well, there is some small piece of RNA that can self-replicate and grow bigger, but we never found that thing yet, and we can't make that thing yet, but it exists, and that's why we have life. Well, that's another act of faith.
Right.
So, you know, it's not that any of these ideas is clearly nonsense. It's just that, you know, they're not supported by science.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as a card-carrying, dyed-in-the-wool scientist, I have to say that, you know, science really has no clue, and it's the greatest mystery. But there is one conclusion that I do come to as a result of my calculations, and that is, if we do find alien life somewhere else in the universe that's completely unrelated to us, you know, that had its own unique beginning, independent of ours, then I claim that they're going to have the same DNA we do.
Hmm.
They're going to have DNA designed with the same biochemistry as humans, amoebas, and elephants. And the reason I claim that is it's so difficult to create that DNA, that if there were two ways to do it, and one was even slightly more difficult than the other, then it would take trillions of years longer to make the one that's less favorable.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in that sense, only the very best biochemical solution is possible.
Gotcha.
But we must be it.
What's interesting, too, about these ideas is that if we haven't seen life, being generated again on this planet again, it kind of then also lends more possibility of transpermia, of an idea that may perhaps some kind of bacteria hitched a ride here and then it flourished.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's another idea, and you know, that would explain life on Earth, but it doesn't explain how that life originated.
Right. It still doesn't answer the question of how it originated, though.
Right. So my calculation still works for that,
mm-hmm.
because my calculation doesn't really have anything to do with Earth. It has to do with how much carbon there is in the universe.
Right.
So. You know, it may be that life on Earth is a result of, you know, it landed on an asteroid. We know organic material is delivered to the Earth in meteorites, and, you know, we found it. So it does happen. And, in fact, probably most of the water on Earth came from asteroids and meteorites that hit the Earth after it was formed. So we know that there is this exchange of material, at least within our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's where life came from. Maybe it started on Mars and then came to Earth, and, you know, Mars became less habitable and so forth. You know, that would be great to to explore that.
Yeah, or it could be it happened even further away, and then the life, if we find something on Mars, could be very similar to what's here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe life is propagating throughout the cosmos, you know, step by step, over billions and billions of years, but I'd still be interested in finding out how it started.
Right, yeah, that'd be the big question. Really interesting. So, you certainly, I think that that's a really interesting discussion, this whole idea. And it makes, of course, everything more complicated, but, you know, it's important to be as accurate as possible. So, what about this idea? And I want to get into some of the theoretical ideas behind matter and things like this, or hear your thoughts on if there were other civilizations somewhere out there.
Mm-hmm.
A big one of the things, like, you're probably familiar with SETI, and they're looking for, listening to signals. And a lot of them feel like there would be absolutely no way for anything to travel any distance to, let's say, visit or send something to visit.
Right.
Is that your understanding, or you get into more of the theoretics? And I know, you know, people like Michio Kaku talk about how, you know, we may one day discover how to travel through a wormhole or something like that. I wanted to hear your thoughts in that.
Well, the question of space travel is subject to two issues that come from Einstein's theory of relativity. And one is favorable and one's unfavorable. So the unfavorable one, of course, is that Einstein said nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. And really, that's been very well confirmed. And there would be lots of problems in simple logic that would arise if something did travel faster than the speed of light. So in my view, we're stuck with that. The beneficial aspect of Einstein's theory for space travel is that if you travel fast enough, time slows down. So if we were able to put an astronaut in a rocket ship and send him off at 99.9% of the speed of light, then he would live much longer than we would on Earth, because for him, time would be traveling much slower. And so in that sense, an astronaut could travel much further out into space than we might imagine. Now, he wouldn't, by the time he gets back here, we'd be gone, because we're aging at the normal rate. So, you know, maybe that's not what you were hoping for, but at least it does open an avenue for space travel.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of my books, I have a book called A World Without Einstein that discusses all the discoveries and technologies that exist in our world today that depend on Einstein's discoveries and theories in one way or another. Anyway, in that book, I have a space travel handbook. So if you want to go to distant planets, I tell you what the equations are for how fast you have to go and how much fuel you're going to require and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's pretty demanding. Let me just give you one example. If you wanted to travel to a distance of 400 light years, the galaxy is 100,000 light years across, but so 400 light years is not so far. But let's say you wanted to travel that fast, that far. And if you travel at a speed of 99.999, that's five nines altogether, of the speed of light, then the crew is going to age only 24 years in a round trip to an object that's 400 light years away. So on Earth, that voyage is going to take 800 light years. That's 800 years for the rocket to get there and back. But for the astronauts, it's only going to be 24 years. So they'll still be alive. Now, it's going to take 26 billion tons of fuel for each ton of payload.
That's a lot of fuel.
So that's an economic problem.
Yeah.
But the table I have here tells you what the physical limitation is.
How interesting. What about the idea about bending space?
Bending space, yeah. Einstein says that gravity is the result of curved space, and so some people have proposed that we can, instead of just traveling from here to there, what we ought to do is bend the space so there is not so far away. You know, it's like taking a carpet and rolling it up so that the other end of the carpet comes closer. That's a cute notion, but the numbers are very unfavorable.
Hmm.
So you would have to control masses the size of galaxies in order to have an appreciable bending of space. The largest mass in the solar system, of course, is the sun, and it bends space by less than one part in a million. So that, you know, that's not even worth starting with, right?
Yeah, that's not very far.
You need to bend space by factors of 10 or 1,000 or factors of a million to get anywhere, and that means you need trillions and trillions of stars worth of masses to do that.
Mm.
So it's a nice calculation for physicists to play with, but, you know, it's not something... I mean, we're never going to be able to go and have lunch in the Delta Quadrant. That's simply too far away.
Unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I love Star Trek.
I heard that the Delta Quadrant's beautiful.
Yes. I mean, I love Star Trek as much as anyone else, but, you know, that's the difference between science and science fiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're stuck with what we can actually do.
Right. Well, great. And I guess, do you happen to have, I would be remiss if I didn't ask, have you happened to see something abnormal yourself in the sky flying around or anybody you know of?
I haven't myself, no.
Mm-hmm.
I have a dear friend who said that he was abducted by aliens and he had a scar on his hand to prove it. But he also confessed to the fact that that was over a weekend in college when he was drinking with his friends.
Ah, was he kidding about, was he serious?
No, he was absolutely serious.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, he didn't have much more to add.
Right.
Because he was out the whole time, according to him.
Mm-hmm.
And,
gotcha.
You know, I was in college, too, and I was drinking with my friends on some weekends, and... You know,
yeah.
I have another explanation for what he might have perceived.
So I guess, although I do want to ask one more question, and that is that especially with Kepler and NASA and all of these projects going on, it feels a lot like, and I'm sure, which is a great thing for the marketing departments of all of these groups, that we're on the cusp of discovering life off of our planet. However, looking at your numbers and figures, we might not be so close to it.
I think we're, you know, if you're going to pursue something as monumental a task as that, you need to have enthusiasm, and NASA does,
mm-hmm.
and keep focusing on, you know, the positive side. But I think the numbers are more daunting than they talk about. I think eventually we will be able to measure atmospheres of these exoplanets and see whether they have organic material in them, and that will be fabulous. I think it's going to be many centuries before we could actually get there to confirm what type of life it is, because, you know, those signals in the atmosphere on Earth existed for billions of years before the first animals walked on a solid surface. So human beings are a very recent addition to the planet Earth. I mean, to find intelligent life will be much more difficult than to find any bacterial life.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great search, and, you know, I think it enriches the human spirit to go after this stuff. You know, that's what our species has always done. And it's hardwired in our genes to go after discovery, to climb the next mountain, to look over the next, you know, the other side and see what's there. And we have advanced as a species from living in caves to where we are today because of that characteristic. So we should support it.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Thank you so much, Robert, for being on the show. This has been really fascinating discussion, and it's brought some of this whole mystery behind the boson and the excitement a little, I can understand it a little better. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Alejandro. And if any of your listeners wants to send me an email, I'll be happy to accept emails, and I'll try to get back to people. And can I give a website address they could send those to?
Definitely, yeah. I will be talking. I'll reiterate it later, too. But I don't think I have the email address, so that'd be great if you tell them what that is.
Well, if they go to the website, they can. There's a button there to send an email. And so the website address is guidetothecosmos.com. That's spelled in the usual way, GUIDETOTHECOSMOS. guidetothecosmos.com. Send me an email, and in the process you could check out the newsletters that are free and some of my radio podcasts that you can download for free, and even check out my books, which you can get at half price on the website.
All right, awesome. Yeah, they look like very interesting books, especially someone's probably going to want a guide to space travel, so they can factor that in their spare time now that space travel is becoming something that the public is into.
Yeah. That's in the book, A World Without Einstein.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Alejandro. Best wishes.
You too. All right. Thank you so much, Robert. I think that was a fascinating discussion. And to me, it just is, I think the big point is we don't know. So much we don't know. And I think that's terribly interesting that we don't know how life started here on Earth or if it did. That's why it makes me think of Prometheus, where, of course, in the movie, if you haven't seen it yet, you know what? What are you waiting for? It's not my fault you haven't seen it. If I'm giving away some of the secrets, go see it already. But, you know, of these aliens coming and seeding life. Or it makes me think of maybe there's some sort of environment, like a sort of asteroid or something out there where life is created in a microbial form, and just then seeds other planets that are more hospitable to more advanced life that then creates, you know, flourishes there. It certainly, I don't, in my eyes, doesn't mean that it is necessarily as rare. In fact, you know, maybe these bits of life are now, you know, all over the place. So, and we'll find more with the more exploration that we do. You know, what if they do find life on Mars or on the moon? And, of course, some scientists believe they have found evidence of life on Mars. And I think we need to remember that because, of course, there was an asteroid piece that some scientists are arguing, no, these are microbes on this from Mars on this asteroid, and it's under debate, and many believe they have it wrong, but it's still under debate. There's so much we just don't know. Same with traveling at great distances. We don't know. Just because we don't know how to do it doesn't mean it's not possible, and look what we've accomplished, especially with nuclear power. That's harnessing the power of the sun. And if we can harness the power of the sun, who knows what else we can do. Anyway, some fascinating discussion. Really makes me think. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. Don't forget to go to UFODailyNews.com for the stories that we talked about earlier and to find out more about lots of what's going on in the UFO world. Thank you all so much for joining me. And we will talk to you next week. Oh.